The Peace and Liberty Podcast, episode 12. If you've ever wondered if Austrian economists exist in academia, you'd be right in noting that on average they are far and few, and hopefully in time that trend will change. But today I'm talking with my good friend Dennis Foster, or more accurately, Dr. Dennis Foster. He grew up in Denver, Colorado, where I live now, and he went on to attend college at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa, majoring in economics. After a year working in, for the Colorado National Bank, he went to graduate school at the University of Hawaii. He received both his MA and PhD there in economics. So for the past 28 years, he has taught at economics at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona. He has long been an ardent proponent of free markets. He's a super knowledgeable guy, and we've had many great discussions. In fact, Dennis is part of our Rothbard Roundtable group, which we do every Saturday, and it's a ton of fun. Reach out to me if you want to get involved in it. But Dennis, thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, it's my pleasure, Stephen.
So you've told me about your experiences as a professor many times, and your story regarding tenure is especially representative of how crazy the environment is for professors who hold non-mainstream views, but we'll get to that later. How did you eventually drift towards economics, which is your profession? And you can take it back as far as you'd like, to college days or whatever you want to talk about.
Well, actually, I was always interested in politics. And so when I started school, I was a political science major, but I was not doing very well. I took my first econ class when I was a second semester sophomore, and I learned the principle of comparative advantage. So I switched my majors to economics, and I was able to actually still look at political science, still look at politics, but through the lens of economics since then. So I really enjoy the fact that I changed economics.
Now, would you say you grew up in a conservative family? Were you always leaning to the right, or did you? Yeah.
I wouldn't say that my family was very political at all. I would say, in general, my father was more conservative. My mother, perhaps a little bit more liberal, but I'm not sure that really politics played much of a role, if at all, in my upbringing. It was just something I was interested in.
I mean, do you think you'd call yourself a libertarian? Or do you think you called yourself a libertarian more so after you became involved in economics? Or,
Yes, I'm sure I didn't even know the term back in those days. Mm. And my interest in economics stemmed from my interest in politics. And as I went through school, I did develop a pretty strong sort of support for free markets, at least at the microeconomic level. But I would say I was sort of typical of students that were taught the Keynesian macroeconomics. And I carried that around with me for quite a long time before I was finally able to sort of shed that.
That's awesome. Yeah, so I mean, you've been a professor for the past 28 years at, Northern Arizona University, is that correct?
That's right.
And obviously you've seen things in academia that you've seen attempts to shut down opposing views. Can you think of any stories off the top of your head that's just been like, wow, that's crazy?
Well, it is a little bit unusual. I teach in a business college, and I think as a general rule, business colleges tend to be, if not more conservative, at least a lot more neutral and a lot easier places to have a wide variety of views. And I think that's true on my campus as well. Outside of the business college, it seems like it's a typical liberal college. But inside, things are generally pretty good. I had Tom Woods actually come to NAU some years ago, I know 7 or 8 years ago, and I would say it was received pretty well by students. Now, on the other hand, it was another speaker, Richard Salzman from the Ayn Rand Institute. I had him come a few years before Tom, and right the day after his presentation, the president of the Faculty Senate sent a blistering email to all of the deans and others around campus that helped fund that speaker on my behalf, criticizing that choice. And it's like, well, that's what happens when you step outside the doors of the business college.
Exactly. I mean, another question I was going to ask you is, what has your relationship been with like other econ professors? Have you had a lot of disagreements with them, specifically in regards to you being an Austrian economist? But I'm guessing you're required to teach some type of Keynesian economic stuff, even though you reject Keynesianism.
Well, you almost have to, because you have to explain to students what the landscape looks like. Right. And so I do that in my macroeconomics classes and also my money and banking classes. I talk about Keynes, talk about Friedman, but then I usually finish with the Austrian story. So that's the last one they get, and presumably, since most people just remember the last thing they get, that's what they sort of sticks with them.
Yeah, you know, me and you have actually talked about this before. I imagine you've had some pretty arrogant students through your courses, but in fact, I mentioned this to you that looking at your ratemindprofessor.com, you've had some pretty harsh reviews. Let me give you a few of them. Foster is very opinionated. He is a hardcore libertarian and pushes his views in the classroom. This is a crazy thing they complained about. There is no real textbook for the class. He tells you to purchase 3 books on Amazon. While they are cheaper than the average textbook, they complain about that. they're all written from an extremely biased libertarian point of view. It is not appropriate for a class to be so one-sided. That was one. Here's another. He teaches harder material than every other macroeconomics teacher, is boring, and assigns tedious and vague homework. Jeez, what's wrong with these people? And then one last one. So libertarian that he can't focus on anything else. Teaches his beliefs rather than the course. I mean, holy mackerel, this is the type of students you've had to deal with, I imagine.
Well, I will say, though, that's a small minority. I do have them read. I have them read Tom Wood's Meltdown book. I have them read a book by John Stossel called No, They Can't. And I ask them to write reactions to the material. And I tell them that I'm not going to grade their reaction. I'm just going to grade the fact that they, you know, were able to articulate whether they agreed or disagreed and why. And I don't get more than maybe 5% that kind of disagree with those viewpoints. A lot of them feel like somehow they got shut out of that information growing up, and feel quite appreciative of that somebody actually was able to expose them to this.
I would imagine it would be like that. I mean, when I read reviews like this, hopefully it is just a few minority of kids that are just mad. And, you know,
I think who fills those out anyway, right?
Yeah, I've never filled out a Rate My Professor form. Yeah, that
now,
is interesting.
I have a plan, though, this semester. I was thinking that I might give my students extra credit for going out to that site and then writing a review, and if the score gets high enough, then I'll give them some extra credit.
That'd be funny. I mean, I honestly do use Rate My Professor because I'm a college student. I do use that site, and if I see like a 1-star professor, that's the free market to work, baby. So yeah, we'll try to get your reviews up with that extra credit. So this is the most interesting thing I think you've ever told me. That your college, you've been a professor for 28 years of this college. They have never given you tenure. And nearly your 3 decades of teaching there. Tell us about that. I mean, that just sounds unfathomable.
Well, it's the nature of the system. There's a lot less objectivity than you might think, sort of looking at it from the outside. It's who you know, who agrees with you, where you think you fit in. I got shot down a couple of times when I applied for tenure. I guess that's kind of a good thing, because if you actually get a tenure track position and you don't get tenure, then you have to leave. So at least for me, I've never had to leave, but that's because I've never been able to swing a tenure track position.
Well, I think one thing you've also mentioned is that not getting tenure means you can be a little more open about your libertarian views and not have to worry so much. It's like, fine, don't give me tenure, but I'm going to be open-minded about it, about all my views.
And I think actually it works in my favor. They don't mind having somebody that's a little bit of a loose cannon there, because I don't have tenure. So yes, you're right. In kind of an odd way, I have maybe more freedom to speak because I don't have tenure.
Hey, that's subjective value in a nutshell, man. But there's a few more questions I have for you. So you're an avid hiker, and you've mentioned to me that you've logged over 350 hikes totaling over 750 days, and you've camped over 400 nights in the canyons, in the canyon backcountry. And you've also worked for major concessionaires on both the South Rim and North Rim of the canyon. Now, here's something even more interesting. You've heavily critiqued the management practices of the National Park Service, and this amounts to newspaper editorials, a monograph published by the Goldwater Institute, and a testimony presented before a congressional committee. Tell me about that last part specifically, because I think that one common argument against libertarians is that we want to destroy national parks and set up casinos on the edge of the Grand Canyon and just turn it onto a free market. I mean, you have a different take on these things. I'd love to hear what you said during this congressional to this congressional committee.
Well, I mean, first you start with the fact that the National Park Service is really just like a big socialist organization anyway. They love to have more and more control. And for them, there's no such thing as a limit. And so they always come up with these plans and these ideas. And I guess it was about 20 years ago, almost 20 years ago, the Park Service was proposing a rail system that would take tourists into the park from just outside the boundary. And as they proposed this, the cost kept going up higher and higher and higher, and nobody was really opposing it. And I started writing editorials. I wrote this monograph. I got invited to go to speak to the subcommittee of the House of Representatives in Washington and give my little spiel about how I thought this was a terrible idea, that it was just going to make tourists, you know, hate going there. And it turns out that Congress ended up defunding this idea, and it went away, and it hasn't seen the light of day since. So I've been very happy about that result.
Now, I don't keep up too much with the mainstream news. I really try not to, but wasn't Trump trying to do something with the national parks and people were freaking out about it?
I know that, I mean, there was some complaints about just the general approach. I know out here we have this new national monument that President Obama declared, and Trump sent the Secretary of the Interior out on a little fact-finding mission, and he recommended that it be pared down by about 80%, so that a lot of it would go back into the private sector, and that's caused a lot of howls. But it's one of those things where there's no end point. The Grand Canyon National Park has gotten bigger and bigger over the years, and then the areas around the Grand Canyon start getting special designation. They go from national forest to national monument to wilderness areas, and it's just, there's no end in sight in terms of how much of this land is going to be taken away from potential private use.
Yeah, I mean, I forget the numbers. You know, the government owns a crazy amount of land. Just in like Nevada alone, I think it was 85% of land there, something like that.
Over 80%, yes.
And I forget if it's about like half of the land to the west. I forget the exact percentages, like I said, but they own an incredible amount of land that, yes, it would be put to good use privately. But I'm not sure I ever asked you this, so this would be new information for me too, but have you ever written any articles that have been in published journals, maybe something I can link to at the end?
I do have some journal articles. You could link to them, but some of them are open. Some of them may not be open. Most of the stuff I've written has been on Grand Canyon management and some of those issues. So also, I have a website. It's kaibabjournal.com. And on there, I have a series of editorials I've written for the local newspaper when I was on their, a public member on their editorial board a couple of times. So some people may find some of those interesting. I've used those opportunities to try to push more of a libertarian viewpoint.
Yeah, that sounds great. How do you spell that website? And I'm going to link to that.
It's K-A-I-B-A-B journal, JOURNAL.com.
All right, got it. Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you, Dennis. You're always so full of knowledge, and I always learn something from you. And funny enough, I'll be seeing you in just a few minutes for the Rothbard Roundtable. So
that's right.
We do that every Saturday at 9 p.m. Mountain Time, which is also 8 p.m. Pacific, 11 p.m. Eastern. Again, let me know if anyone wants to join us and learn real economics. Thanks so much for coming on, Dennis. I think it's important for others to know that there are other Austrian economists like you trying to instill some sanity into the students you encounter.
Yes, thank you very much, Stephen.
All right, well, we'll do it all again tomorrow. This is Stephen Clyde here letting you know that they can't stop these ideas from spreading. Real economics and real history will prevail, as always, for peace and liberty. Hey everyone, please like, follow, donate, subscribe, and share. Any donations will be used to reach more people.